Amen. Daniel chapter 6. The theme of chapter 6 will be much the same as we have seen in prior chapters, and that is, despite the appearances to the contrary, God is in control, meaning that God has a plan for his people, and that plan was going to occur, and no one or no nation could do anything to stop it. And at the conclusion of chapter 5, we saw that Belshazzar, king of Babylon, was slain, and the city of Babylon taken by the Medes of the Persians. And so the Babylonian Empire falls, and an empire led and unified by Cyrus the Great, or Cyrus II, rises. And Cyrus is noteworthy because he's mentioned by name in Isaiah. And to, at least to my knowledge, you know, he's really the only person in scripture who is prophesied in such a way and is mentioned by name. And so let's go over to Isaiah really quickly in chapter 44. And we can see that starting in verse 28, so at the end of the chapter. And so Isaiah writes and says, "It is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. And he declares of Jerusalem, she will be built, and of the temple, your foundation will be laid. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him, and to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him, so that the gates will not be shut." And so we have not only Cyrus being mentioned by name some 200 years or so, you know, prior to the events that are occurring in chapter 6. We also have the prophecy that under Cyrus's rule, Jerusalem or the Jews would finally leave Babylonian captivity. And they would go in waves, essentially, to restore the temple and to rebuild. As we've been looking about, as Nathan has been preaching on in Haggai and Zechariah, kind of that time period. And so Cyrus is notable for that reason, right? At least I don't know of anybody else who was prophesied by name like that. And so the fact that God already knew not only what his name would be, but also what God would accomplish through him is, again, amazing, right? It's an amazing prophecy. And so we have Cyrus, who is the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. And then we have this Darius character, right? At the beginning of chapter 6, it says, "It seemed good to Darius," or rather at the end of chapter 5, it says, "So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And so if Cyrus is the king, well, then who is this Darius the Mede character that we meet? Well, there are two possibilities. You know, Darius could be like a governor who was appointed over Babylon or that immediate region in the broader empire, while Cyrus was, of course, you know, the emperor or head king over that entire empire. And some, of course, have some questions over this as, well, there isn't really any historical evidence about a governor named Darius in that sense. But it's very much possible that Darius might be known by another name. And maybe it's that name that is used for any writings or tablets or official documents. And of course, keep in mind, you know, there was a similar issue with Belshazzar. You know, for the longest time, there weren't any historical records of him either. And then archaeologists discovered those records. And so just because we haven't found any records of Darius just yet doesn't mean that there aren't any at all. Another possibility, and this is the one that I tend to favor, is that Darius the Mede is simply Cyrus the Persian. Darius simply being his Median name, while Cyrus is his Persian name. He was of dual descent. He was a descent of Mede as well as Persia. And, you know, dual titles for a Medo-Persian king would definitely not seem out of place in a book like Daniel. You know, recall that the book itself is written in two different languages. It's written in Hebrew and in Aramaic. We know Daniel and his three friends have two different names. They have their Hebrew name and they have their Babylonian name. And of course, since Cyrus is half Persian and half Median, you know, the dual names would have satisfied both peoples or both nationalities. And so very possible that Darius is simply Cyrus, right? And so those are your two options, and you're welcome just to take your pick of your favorites or discover a third. But that's the introduction to chapter 6. And so let's go ahead and jump into the text itself. And so I'll ask Michael if you could read verses 1 through 5, please.
It reads, "It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, 'We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God.'"
All right, so this has likely been maybe 1 or 2 years since the Medo-Persian Empire has taken over Babylon, and already, you know, Daniel is back in action, and he's distinguished himself above his peers once again, right? And we see, again, just the diligence and the wisdom of Daniel. And as Darius begins to set up the structure of this newly acquired kingdom, he appoints Daniel as one of three commissioners. But more than that, the king intends to promote Daniel even higher still. You know, Daniel probably has a lot of things going for him over his peers. He, of course, had a good reputation. He was not a Chaldean. You know, that was probably important to Darius. But he was more than familiar with their system. And so he had a lot of wisdom in that sense and could provide some guidance to the local people. And he was definitely experienced. By now, he's around 80 at this point. So again, this is a long time Daniel has been in Babylon. But more importantly, God was on Daniel's side, and God wanted Daniel in this position to influence this new government. And as we have seen from Daniel, from the age of 13 all the way to the age of 80 or so, you know, the one thing that we can say for sure is that Daniel did not suffer from a lack of courage to do God's will. You know, Daniel never shrinks back from all that God wants him to be. Many people probably cringe when faced with the effort and the difficulty of stretching themselves to do the great things that God has called them to do. You know, even though they are capable, they say, "Well, I can't." You know, picture Moses at the burning bush, right? This future leader of Israel stands there saying that, well, he's not qualified, right? And he asks God to send Aaron instead, right? And we see, of course, the presence of Moses later in his life. But again, we see this image of Moses saying, "Well, I can't, right? I'm not qualified." And how many of us are like that? But then you picture Daniel, you know, as a young teenager, and we never saw him saying he was too young, right? That he was too inexperienced, that he wasn't qualified. And even now, Daniel is in his 80s. And again, he doesn't say that he's too old, that he's too tired, that he's ready to rest and go into retirement. You know, Daniel was ready to do whatever God wanted him to do at any time. And if only the church had more Daniels, right? All that we could accomplish. You know, probably nothing would stifle church growth faster than a lack of courage to do God's will. Comments or questions on that? Well, just as we saw with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, jealousy and possibly greed quickly rears its ugly head. Nathan, I saw you came off mute. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to mention the final verse that Michael read. Again, just testifies to the quality of character that Daniel had, to where his enemies knew that the only way they could find a charge against him is if it was in regards to the law of his God. And again, that is a shows the commendable dedication and commitment that Daniel had shown throughout his life, that those who did the best to find something wrong with them knew that there wasn't anything. And the only way they'd find a charge again is if they somehow made the law violate his commitment to God.
Yep. And so you have these, those who are jealous and envious of Daniel, and they seek once again to bring him down. And as Nathan pointed out, right, but they have this problem that they can't, they can find no fault. They can find no error with Daniel of which to accuse him of. You know, the only way would be to have to devise a plan to use his commitment to God's law against them, right? They just had nothing to work with. And what a compliment is that. You know, that these accusers knew that the only way to succeed would be to put Daniel in a position where he would have to choose between obedience to God and obedience to the government, right? Because they knew which one he would choose, right? They knew without a doubt that he would choose God's law. You know, is that how people see us? You know, if someone wanted to say something bad about me, you know, would they find it? I know I probably need to do a better job of making sure that the most anyone can ever truthfully accuse me of is simply following the law of God, right? That's something we should all be striving for. Let's go ahead and continue on. And I'll ask Noah if you can read for us verses 6 through 9. Actually, I don't see Noah on. I'll go ahead and read that. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. And so here's the problem to their idea. You know, they want to get Daniel in trouble, and they wanted to use his obedience to the God of the Jews against him. But Persia has no law against monotheism. And so they have to devise a plan to create such a law, right, or such an injunction. And they do so in a way that to Darius, it would appear harmless, right? To Darius, it would look merely political, but it would pose a religious issue for Daniel. And then notice how these envious accusers show up in a group to work their plan, right? Not unsurprising to see such people traveling in a pack. It's easier to do evil things when you're not doing it alone, right? Whereas those who do right, you know, just as Jesus would stand alone the night before he was crucified. And perhaps Darius should have noticed that Daniel was not present when the others came forward, right? He was intending to appoint him head over commissioners, and so you might expect him to be there. But Darius doesn't, likely because he's completely unsuspecting, right? He has no idea that these men were out to deprive the king of his most trusted advisor. And so they plan to devise this scheme to get Darius to agree to these conditions for 1 month, right? All petitions and all prayers in the realm must be directed toward Darius only. And those who disobeyed would be cast into a den of lions. And I imagine for Darius, this was probably very flattering for him, right? It reinforced the idea that the empire was under new management, and which is probably why he had no problem agreeing to this, right? And it was a reasonable time limit. And so perhaps he saw no harm, to this seemingly modest request for only 30 days. What's the big deal? Especially if it's going to help unify the kingdom under this new kingship, right? And so the king agrees and the edict is established. Comments or questions through verse 9. All right, Stuart, if you could go ahead and read for us verses 10 through 15.
Verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. He continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The king replied, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition 3 times a day. Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed.
So in verse 10, we read that Daniel at some point did in fact learn that the document had been signed. And so whatever he does next cannot be said to have been done in ignorance. He knew the law and he knew the penalty for breaking it. But notice what we do not see in verse 10. We do not see Daniel wondering what he should do. He's not in turmoil. He's not anxious with indecision. In fact, because there was no decision to be made at this point, really. He had already made that some 80 years ago. Daniel had committed himself to following God. And all we see now is his continued and unflinching obedience to that commitment. And then in verse 11, we see the group waiting around for Daniel to pray as they knew he would. And then they went and reported it to Darius as soon as he did. But notice again their deviousness, right? As in verse 12. Notice how they say, did you not sign an injunction, O king? Suddenly it's as if this whole thing has become the king's idea. And then in verse 13, they say, Daniel, one of the exiles, they want to make sure to throw in the fact that this Daniel is not one of us. Possibly planting the seed that because of that, Daniel is all the more likely to be disloyal, right? To dishonor you, O king. And all of this is not dissimilar to what happened to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had this false charge both times because it was not true then, and it's not true now that any of those four individuals paid no heed to the king, right? They honored the king and they gave him proper respect. It was not true that Daniel did not regard the king. They just did not. They did not give their ultimate loyalty to any earthly king, right? That belonged to God and God alone. Now the difference here is with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar reacted exactly as those accusers hoped he would react. Here, though, Darius's response was likely not what the conspirators had hoped for. For Darius, he's become very upset. He's upset probably with these tricksters, but also probably with himself. for allowing these serpents to trick him. And he realizes now, you know, the real reason for this decree. You know, he was unsuspecting at first, but now he sees why they wanted this decree in place. And he had been duped by Daniel's enemies. And so he's probably very much regretting not having discussed the matter with Daniel beforehand. And then in verse 14, it tells us that the king, in fact, labored to deliver Daniel until the sun went down, right? This is the point when you call in the lawyers, right? The best lawyers you have, the really overpaid ones that will help you find loopholes in the system. You know, Darius wanted to save Daniel however he could. But the fact of the matter is, there simply weren't any loopholes, right? There was nothing he could do. He could have provided Daniel with armor, maybe, right? Some form of protection, a sword. Could have even tried and fed the lions beforehand so that they weren't hungry. But all that would have done was simply undermined the law of the Medes and the Persians, right? And so even Darius recognized that it was going to take a miracle for Daniel to be saved. That was Daniel's only hope. And then in verse 16, we see the king speaking to Daniel and saying, you know, your God, whom you constantly serve himself, will deliver you. And so we often talked about the faith of Daniel, but how about the faith of Darius here? That's pretty impressive. You know, that's not his God. That's not the God that he honors. And if he does, it's not the only one. But again, we see Darius's confidence in Daniel sort of translate to his confidence in the God that Daniel obeys and that Daniel worships. So that in of itself is also impressive for me to have another pagan king, right, recognize and acknowledge the power and sovereignty of God. Comments and questions through verse 15. All right, Nick. If you could go ahead and read for 16 through 23.
Then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. Then the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. When he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God.
So at the beginning of this, we see again just how distressed the king was. You know, all night he ate no food, he enjoyed no entertainment, and could not sleep. But as soon as it was light, he runs to the pit to check on Daniel. It makes me wonder at this point what the conspirators think about how the king is reacting here. Clearly, the king cares for Daniel. And they're probably worried that if anything happens to Daniel, the king is likely to seek revenge against them. So they might be quaking here just a little bit, right? I imagine they're probably starting to sweat at this point by verse 19. And so Darius rushes to the den and he calls out to Daniel, and he refers to Daniel as a servant of the living God. And we saw Nebuchadnezzar had experienced firsthand on multiple occasions the truth of that statement, and that the God of the Jews is the living God. And now Darius is going to witness, you know, that firsthand for himself as well. Because once again, Daniel's faithfulness would give God an opportunity to show his power to a pagan ruler. And so Daniel calls out and he tells the king that God had sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions because Daniel was innocent in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the king. And regardless of whatever rules or laws or edicts earthly rulers may want to establish to determine our guilt or to determine our innocence, you know, ultimately it is God and God's law that we are to obey, right? We must seek to be innocent in the eyes of God. You know, we must not fear those who can only destroy the flesh, but fear the one who can destroy both the soul and the body. Comments or questions to verse 23?
Harper, I think Nathan?
Go for it, Stuart. Yep, go for it.
Oh, okay. I think that's a very good point that you bring up. The faithfulness of Daniel kind of created this opportunity to a certain regard. You know, Daniel constantly served God. He was constantly praying to him all of his life. And it was because of that, that he was kind of ready for this situation and ready for any situation that came his way to serve and glorify God. That just reminds me of the kind of Christian that I need to be today, you know, constantly serving God in prayer and in Bible study and my thoughts and my actions. And the more consistent I am with that, the more opportunities there will be, the more opportunities I'll notice and arguably take advantage of to give glory to God, whether it is including him in a conversation or what be it, serving him in action and deed. So that consistency every day, I think we see here is critical to increasing our opportunities we have with others on spiritual matters.
Absolutely. And it just says, you know, Jesus tells us to let our light shine, right? And that they may see our good deeds and glorify the Father in heaven. Nathan?
I am, again, impressed with kind of reading Daniel in light of some of the events that we've experienced in our own country. And while the pandemic and the reason to suspend services that some congregations have had to go through throughout the country, there's a lot of discussion that should be had and is appropriate to have about that. But if there is any time where the government tries to forbid you or anyone tries to forbid you from something God has commanded you to do, the example of Daniel in the lion's den is something that we need to keep in mind. And again, I'm not trying to say this is perfectly parallel to our situation today, because I don't think that it is. Daniel is to inspire us in that conviction to obey God rather than man.
And Daniel, I think, is a great example in that sense, right? And, you know, are we going to conform to the world around us, or are we going to seek to transform it as Daniel has striven to do? Michael?
Well, I was going to say a lot of the same stuff that Nathan did. I couldn't take my hand down fast enough. But, yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic reminder, obviously, of priorities to God and the rewards, I guess, that come after that. And then along the same lines, it's still a fantastic example of still following God and committing to him consistently, yet still obeying the law of the land and following the law of the land, which I know all of us here can attest that we will absolutely put God first, but sometimes we see that the law of the land for others can definitely take over. That's a really good example of the right priorities and a good balance.
I have some of these thoughts on the worksheet if you happen to have that open. But we see Daniel very much a stranger in a strange land, right? Taken from his early youth into a foreign society. And maybe then sometimes that's how we feel, right? Especially with everything going on and the values and the morals on the decline of the society in which we live, perhaps we feel like a stranger in a strange land. And yet we see Daniel and we see how he did not withdraw from the world in which he lived. You know, he engaged with those around him, even though there was a great disparity in what Daniel believed and his convictions versus those, you know, his peers and those he worked with and their convictions. We see Daniel both obeying God's law and being as faithful as he possibly could and working for God's glory, while at the same time still being able to also work with the Babylonians and to work with the Persians. You know, despite what Nebuchadnezzar did to Daniel's home and his people, Daniel was resolved to be a diligent and faultless worker. You know, he could have tried and stirred up a rebellion. He could have tried and taken revenge. But instead, he sought to use his gifts to transform the culture around him. You know, he wanted Babylonian life to be shaped by the values of the one true God. And so he worked for Babylon, right? He worked for to help prosper Babylon, right? To make Babylonian life better. And he was able to identify where his values and the Babylonian values overlapped. And through that diligent work, right, his masters and his overlords and his overseers became convinced of his excellence and convinced that Daniel shared their vision of the future, right? That Daniel was working for the betterment of the people, but he did so in a way that glorified God. And so that, I think that's something that we can take away and learn a lot from, and to not separate ourselves from a society that which has very different values and morals, but find where that common ground is and still work to glorify God, but in a way that you're able to be diligent and to still help those and transform those around you. Other comments or questions through verse 23? Let's go ahead and conclude the chapter. And so, Cameron, if you could read verses 24 through 28.
The king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel. And they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land. May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian.
So a lesson we would all do well to remember, when faced with false accusations, God knows the truth. And God will never be fooled by a false accusation. We know that Satan is an accuser of God's people, and that he accuses us night and day. And we need to make sure that whatever he accuses us of is not true. Right? We should be striving in a way that the only thing anyone can accuse us of is obedience to God's word. And then we see the fate of those who maliciously accuse Daniel. Without any trial, without any hearing, Darius has them and their families paraded past Daniel and thrown into the pit. They were essentially dead before they even hit the bottom. It's almost as if these lions were in a rather foul mood for some reason. Perhaps because they had just been forced to sit there and stare at their dinner all night without actually being able to partake. And so they were just chomping at the bit to get to their meal. And while it doesn't say this, you know, my assumption is that Daniel doesn't object to this either. You know, which again, I think is a testament to his faith. You know, Daniel knows that God is the ultimate judge, and who are we to get in the way when he does so? And as with Nebuchadnezzar at the end of chapter 4, Darius now had a new understanding of God. We saw his faith early on before even these events, and so I can only imagine Darius's newfound understanding of the power of God. And it shows in his decree, right? It was clear to all that God was a living God and that he worked in history to bring about justice and to further the welfare of his people. And in fact, it's while all of this is going on that his people, as promised, are returning to the Holy Land, right? They're either on their way or they're already there in that first wave. And so they are already back out of captivity. Daniel remains in Babylon, again, most likely because this is where God wanted Daniel to be. Right? God knew the value and the work that Daniel could accomplish on his behalf to continue to steer Darius in the direction that God needed him to go. Comments or questions through verse 28 or through the end of the chapter?
Okay. I think to me, I can compare this to John chapter 9 about the blind man when the disciples asked Jesus who sinned that he was blind. Jesus said, neither his parents nor him. The man sinned, but so that the work of God may be manifest. So it's the same thing. You know, God could have stopped the king from throwing Daniel into the lion den, but he didn't. They throw him in so that they can see the power of God. So sometimes things happen for people to know the power of God.
Absolutely. God very well could have prevented all of this from even happening in the first place, but you're absolutely right. You know, all of this was again to demonstrate the power and the sovereignty of God. There was a number of hands that went up simultaneously, so I'll go ahead and start with Nathan.
I was just going to mention on the judgment upon the false accusers and Daniel's response to it. Interestingly, under the law, a false witness, one found to be a false witness, would always receive the punishment that their testimony would have brought upon the one they were falsely accusing. And so you got that angle to think about their false accusation. Also, you have the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth principle, in that the very, again, punishment that they were trying to bring upon Daniel, they ended up bringing upon themselves.
Good point. I hadn't thought about that, but absolutely good point there. Carl?
Yeah, along the lines of what Nathan was saying, I was going to take it back even further to the promise that was made to Abraham that God was going to bless those who bless you and God is going to curse those who curse you. Because to set yourself up against the children of Israel, you know, unless you're bringing God's judgment upon them, is to set yourself up against God. And so we see it here. We see it in the book of Esther, right? When they conspire to kill the Jews, and the very gallows is built for Mordecai is used on, we forget his name. But you see the same thing there.
And I think that's a testament, right, that God will deliver his people. And even though, you know, there are many martyrs, you know, God does, at least we don't see it clearly. that God is miraculously protecting his people today, but we know that judgment will come and that those who accuse and revile and oppress God's people will be judged. Absolutely. Ben.
Yeah, I was going to say that this is all that we're studying now. These are examples of God's dealings with Gentiles. And true, it's the leaders, but and we don't know what God expected of Nebuchadnezzar or Darius or Cyrus as far as their eternal destiny. That's in his hands. And he will judge through Jesus Christ all of us. But these are just the recorded interactions. There could be a lot more that he had. At some point he gave the Gentiles over generally, but the justice of God and the love of God for all mankind, we don't know what he was doing on behalf of certain individuals, certain people, whether any of the people that Jonah preached to were saved or they were spared judgment. But God is a fair and just God and patient. And these stories like this are reassuring to me, not only from the Jews, but also the Gentiles that he's dealing with. The second thing I was going to say, and I never want to get political, but even though Darius was probably an idolatrous man, Daniel was faithful and loyal to him. And I encourage people that I come in contact with to exercise all of their rights as American citizens. But we as Christians are responsible for being loyal and faithful subjects within the law of God to whomever won prior elections and the coming elections. We act with dignity and honor as the children of God. And that is our responsibility, including the way we talk, what we post online, what we say to others. We need to act with dignity.
Absolutely. Great point. Well, chapter 6 concludes the narrative portion of Daniel. And in chapter 7 next week, we will switch gears quite a bit, and we will start to get into the meat of the apocalyptic writings. But even in the first 6 chapters, you know, God has demonstrated through Daniel, you know, the power and the sovereignty of God. And all of this essentially prepares the way for the prophecies in this second half of the book. You know, if God could deliver from the fiery furnace, and if he could deliver from the lion's den, then surely he also possessed the miraculous ability to predict the future. And so we're going to see a lot of that. You know, this, and there is a little bit of a primer in the handout for chapter 7, a full page's worth. And so I would invite you and encourage you to take a look at that before next week. And then that will allow us to dive right into the text when we come back together.